Hello, my name's Craig Barker. I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the museum where we examine the relationship between a guest and one of the objects within the collection of the museum. It's currently National Archaeology Week in Australia, and today my guest is Madeline Robinson from the Department of Archaeology at the University of Sydney. Madeline is the Archaeological Support Officer for the department and soon to be a doctoral researcher as well. Welcome, Madeline. Thank you very much for joining us in Object Matters.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first up, before we actually talk about the object and your relationship with it, could you begin by speaking about your background and your own research interests?
Yeah, so I have a very interesting and diverse background. I've got an undergraduate degree in archaeology and marine science. As I'm very interested in the relationship that people have with their marine environments throughout our history, I'm interested in everything from coastal adaptation to marine resource management, especially during times of climate change. And so what I'm interested in looking at is how do people overcome pressures of food security, which is a topic that is really relevant today. Yeah. So I have aims to actually use archaeology to address contemporary problems. In addition to this, I do a lot of photogrammetry, which is where you create digital 3D models of an object or a landscape or monument, both above and below water, and you can recreate it in digital space. So moving forward, I'm hoping to combine all these three things in my future research.
Okay, well, look, we're going to come back and touch upon probably all of them, but particularly photogrammetry as we go along. But of course, while we're recording this, it is National Archaeology Week, which is a celebration of archaeology within Australia and also Australian projects internationally as well. I mean, where are some of the places that you've worked as an archaeologist, both in the lab and in the field?
I've been very lucky and worked all over, more recently in Australia because of COVID, unfortunately. But I started out in my honours degree working in Malta, which was amazing. And that was where my photogrammetry career really took off because I made these amazing, the models were amazing of the Neolithic temples of Malta. And I was able to go over there and unfortunately not use a drone. I had to do it all from a DSLR, which was on a monopod, which was a little bit scary sometimes, holding up very expensive camera gear, trying to capture everything. Yeah. And from there, I was able to actually get more work at University of Sydney, and I was working in Sri Lanka at a burial site, actually, which was a really beautiful place in Kantradai. And all the burials were marked with these gorgeous stone stupas. Again, I had to use a monopod, so put my DSLR at the top of, I think it was 6-meter pole to take the photos above.
Yes.
And then from there, I became a research assistant for Professor Peter Hiscock, and through him, we modelled a huge collection of retouch flakes, of hand axes that came from around Australia, but also was able to go to the United States and actually work over there and teach photogrammetry as well. And so it's kind of been all over. Photogrammetry has really opened a door for me to do some really cool stuff. And since then, now I'm the Archaeology Support Officer and I still do a lot of photogrammetry work with the Chow Chak Wing Museum.
Excellent. Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But it's just interesting as you talk about that too, that I think often, you know, dinner parties and so on, we get the, isn't archaeology glamorous? But it's interesting how much necessity is the mother of invention, that even with really extraordinary technology often in the field, and I would imagine sometimes in the museum environment as well, that you've got to be a little bit creative in terms of how you capture material for recording.
Oh, absolutely. You have to, creative is the right word to describe it. I have done underwater archaeology, which is very difficult because if there are any divers listening, you got to get your buoyancy right, but you also have to be really sure that what you're taking photos of are, you know, in the right angle and you've got right distance. So you have to deal with buoyancy and also controlling your camera gear. And the best setup I think I've used is 6 GoPros on a PVC pole, which we just took down to try and get as much coverage
as angles as you could.
Exactly. And try to do it in within an hour, depending on how fast you're breathing.
So, so I mean, you touched upon the Chow Chak Wing Museum. You've been working with us for a couple of years now, on and off. How are you bringing these skills to a museum collection?
So I think I've been doing the work for about think maybe 2.5, it's since COVID started. And I think the initiative was that everyone was locked down. No one had in, you know, was coming onto campus to make, to do for their classes. And, you know, just through conversation, the idea was born that how about I make models of the objects that students would be using for their classes so that they can actually do their analyses, do their work, with the added benefit of actually being able to manipulate and like digitally handle an object without having to be on campus, really. So
that idea of replicating an object-based learning experience with a digital object-based learning experience, which, I mean, as a technology, obviously, and as a concept, did predate COVID, but obviously COVID has changed the rules considerably and becomes a key source for many museums in terms of public engagement and outreach and education, obviously, in this case as well. But, you know, is photogrammetry at the future of archaeology, do you feel?
Oh, I definitely think, I'm massively biased, but I definitely think it's going to be included. You can't, you know, there's a lot of objects that you can't handle. You know, there's going to be material that's not going to be on display or not on in an exhibition. It's going to be in a very protective case or, you know, behind closed doors. So this enables people to come and, you could from anywhere in the world, at home, you just take out your phone and you can open up the site and then you've got this object in your hands, and you're able to zoom in, look at the morphology, and do your these analyses that you couldn't actually do even if you're on campus, if you're in the museum, because you've got a piece of glass in front of you. So it's really breaking that fourth wall. You're able to manipulate and see these objects in a very new light. And I do think that this is going to be a big feature of future archaeology. It's going to become standard practice if it isn't already.
It has increased dramatically in recent years, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
But also, I mean, in terms of that experience of both working within a museum context with objects and then working in the field, differences between capturing both landscapes and objects that can be quite small in some cases, including the one we're about to talk about. But, I mean, how do you find yourself adjusting in terms of using the technology?
Oh, yeah, you do have to adjust. I miss doing landscape because doing object photogrammetry is a lot harder, which is just kind of counterintuitive. You would think that doing something so small is easy. But in actual fact, the smaller you go, the harder it is. I've got a lot of camera gear and a lot of specialized camera gear for doing small objects. But I can spend hours trying to pull these images together to try and make a correct model. Doing landscape is really fun because you're out there, and if you're not using a drone, you've got either a DSLR or mirrorless camera on a monopod or in your hand, and you get to walk around this gorgeous site, and, you know, you're kind of the only things you've got to be wary of, like, you know, the rain. And the sun. Shadows are really annoying. But in a more controlled environment, like in the lab or in the museum, you know, you control the lighting, you control the gear, the angle really accurately. So it does take a lot more time to get things right, especially lighting. That takes forever.
Yeah. So can you just quickly take us through the process of, you know, what type of technologies are you using? What type of equipment are you using? And what are the steps that you would go to capture a museum object such as the one we're about to talk about?
So what I do first is probably set my camera. So the cameras that we've got in the lab are Canon 80Ds. They're a type of DSLR. More importantly, are my lenses, and I've got a lot of lenses. I use macro lenses for anything object-based because I want to get really good close-up images of the surface to get the complexity, but also to get the right texture. So for the coin, the Tetradrachm, I used a 35mm lens so I can get really, really nice and close to the surface to get that a really good image of, you know, Athena's face. So when I set up my camera, I have to adjust my aperture and, you know, my shutter speed and my ISO depending on the lighting environment. And what I use is actually a portable light box, which are really handy because we do have some way more expensive ones in the lab, which are about a few tens of thousands of dollars. But this portable one, basically, you can pop it up anywhere, outside, inside, and it just gives you perfect lighting. It gives you a really good shooting environment. And for this example, for the Tetradrachm, I had to put this coin in a mount because coins are famously really difficult to model They're shiny, they're small, and there's not a lot of crossover from going from one side to the other because they're quite thin. So the mount was the most important thing I had to think about. And so what I did was just get a piece of polystyrene and cut a little nook in the middle. And then from there, I printed off these things called targets, and they're very small. They kind of look like alien crop circles.
Yes.
And you put them, I put four or six around, and that helps the software to actually pull everything together. Exactly. So I ran the model in two chunks. From one side, I put the camera at a very tall angle, so it's called a high angle position, so it's looking down. And then I actually used a tripod to reposition the camera six different times, going from really high angled to low angle, so right through from a parallel position and then looking up. And then did it for both sides, so turning the coin upside down. And then I take all the photos, and I think there are about, I'm going to say about 800 photos. So,
right. Well, that was going to be one of my questions.
Yeah, so, I overshoot. Yeah. I'm a massive overshooter because I have worries about creating holes and then not getting the perfect shot. I also shoot in RAW, so I can do some image editing afterwards just to make sure that I've got all the right colors. You've got to make sure that you color calibrate. You want to get the right texture. And then I chuck it into Metashape, which used to be called PhotoScan. They've got a new one, which updated a few years ago. In the labs here, we've got a couple of really good computers to run some heavy modeling. So put into Metashape, and then I think it was a few days later that I actually got
the result
because I had to do some merging of the two chunks to bring it together.
Right, right. So obviously, we're talking about a coin. I mean, it was interesting you talk about creating a mold, and I'll talk about some of the difficulties with particular objects because obviously probably something with a flat base like a jug would be considerably easier.
Oh, absolutely.
But, I mean, in terms of the coin itself, could you explain to our listeners what it is? Now, this is we're not talking numismatics today. This is not a podcast about coinage per se. This is more about application of technology. But what was the coin that you have chosen today? And why have you chosen this one, I should also ask?
Oh, I have a really weird relationship with this coin because I've seen it and I've actually worked with it a few times. I tried to model the same one back in 2020, and I couldn't do it.
Okay, yep.
So I think at the back of my head, it was really plaguing me that
I become your Moby Dick.
Oh, it has. It definitely was. It really was. And now I've got it. Actually, it's funny because now I've got a new Moby Dick because there's another one, a much smaller coin, which is gold, and that's my next mountain to conquer. But this, the Tetradrachm, is just so beautiful. It's, I don't know. It's just really stunning, and I love holding it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so heavy.
Yeah. Well, it's remarkable. I mean, yeah, it's interesting because we tend to think of coins, particularly modern currency, which is so light, but with ancient coins, Greek coins such as this one, but also Roman and other cultures, there is such a difference in weight, you know, just carrying around things in money bags and pockets must
Absolutely.
Have been so different in antiquity to the way that we're used to, or yeah, not that we use coins much anymore anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
But so this particular one is silver.
Mm-hmm.
And what's on both the obverse and the reverse?
So when you open up the model, if you go to Sketchfab and you open up the model, or if you go onto the Chowchat Wing site, the first face that you'll see is the face of Athena. And she takes up more or less the entire coin. It's not like, you know, our Elizabeth, you know, she's much smaller in the coin. This head of Athena is really quite large. She's got the helmet on. She's facing right. It's a classic Athena picture. On the reverse side, we've got the very standard symbol of Athena, which is the owl.
Yeah.
And it's also got the olive sprig, and then it's got the letters alpha, theta, and epsilon, which is of the Athenians.
Yes, that's right.
So, yes, it is a really beautiful, very, very large. It's a very large coin, not exactly circular. It's got sort of three distinct corners, but it looks well used.
Yeah, it does actually, doesn't it? And it's interesting just looking at it again. So, listeners, we're currently playing, well, I'm playing on Sketchfab at the moment while Madeline's talking. I should have been listening to Madeline, but I'm having so much fun. All jokes aside, it is interesting just how the textures of both sides are so different, which, of course, is part of the process of minting of coins in antiquity with both sides for one, but one is rather converse and the other's convex.
Absolutely.
But, so I guess that added to the challenge of capturing it as well, that it's not a flat surface, obviously.
No, but actually you want rugosity in a surface, you want complexity, you don't want smooth, shiny surfaces. So I did have to change the lighting actually for when I shoot, the objects are always on a turntable, just so I don't have to physically move around the objects to take the photos. I've got it on a turntable, which can also be, it adds a little element of suspense because you just hope everything is still and supported. But as it rotates, the light obviously changes. So you've got to be very wary of shadows being cast. So very often I'll have to get a bit creative and put extra lighting, a ring flash on the camera, which is the best thing ever because it creates consistent, even lighting.
So it's not just for TikTok and Instagram. It's
Oh, no, definitely. This is a very expensive one as well. So, yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting as an object itself, before we talk more about the technology, because the coin itself was minted in Athens, obviously, but minted in the second half of the 5th century BC. Mm. So putting on my classical archaeology hat for a moment, of course, this is, as most listeners will be aware, this was the pinnacle of Athenian power.
Absolutely.
The democracy of Athens, the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah.
And so very symbolic of a whole lot of other things, theatre, philosophy, and so on.
Yeah, true.
From a teaching perspective, why would it be important for our students to access coins, either digitally or...
That's a good question. I think it's a really important thing to remember when you're looking at coins is that, as you said before, they are such standard objects that we usually use in everyday life. So they open up all these questions. Who used this? You know, why did they have it? What did they trade to get it? You know, there's so much story behind this little tiny piece of metal. And that's usually what draws me in when I go to museums. I think about the story behind it because there would have been. So, and with a coin, how many times did it change hands?
Yes.
You know, how many people had this in their purses or in their pockets?
Yeah.
So
how did it get dropped?
Yes. Or was it lost for ages? Did someone drop it somewhere and some lucky kid found it?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you raise all those because, of course, as an archaeological object, coins are obviously fantastic for economic history. But I've got to say that I personally have always engaged with them more in terms of that social history aspect.
Mm.
I've worked on sites both here in Australia and in Cyprus where gold coins have been found.
Mm.
And there's a real buzz across the team. You know, it's very rare, but there's a real buzz across the team when they're found. And it's coins are incredibly tangible, aren't they? Because they're something we all know and recognize.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the key thing. We all know, even though today we're not using coins as much, unfortunately, but we all immediately recognize the importance and also what it represented.
Yep.
It represented a worth that everyone understood.
Yep.
You know, especially with the tetradrachm, they're 4 drachmas.
Yeah.
So it had a quantity to it. And, you know, that's, I think, the it doesn't matter who you are and what time period, everyone can recognize that.
Yeah. So theoretically, the same processes that you've applied to capturing this one, you could do to any coin.
I wish.
The Mediterranean or Asia or more recent Australian coins as well?
Yes and no. It does depend on the size.
Yeah.
So the very tricky gold coin that I'm trying to model, I'm actually going to use different gear. I'm going to use a 90mm macro lens because I need to fill the frame more. So depending on the size of your lens, you're going to have a different frame that you can sort of fill with an object. So the coin that I'm currently trying to model, which is my current Moby Dick, is this Electrum Stator, which is from Sardis in Turkey. And on one side, it's got a lion's head. And on the reverse, it's got squares. It's just this quite square impression.
Yeah, right.
It's about a quarter of the size of the tetradrachm, and it is incredibly shiny. So I've been able to model one side, but I really am struggling to bring the two chunks together. It really doesn't want to because it's just so shiny. And obviously, there are techniques, there are ways to get rid of the shine, but we can't do that. That's even putting talcum powder, weirdly enough, deodorant spray, that will work,
will
matte something.
Okay.
So, yes.
I don't imagine the conservation team will be particularly pleased if you did that.
No, definitely not.
So it's interesting that the surface, it's not just size, but surface makes a major
Absolutely.
Difference in terms of how you can capture.
Oh, yeah. Like when people come to me and they want to have things like bone or stone modelled or wood, I get excited because I know instantly it's going to work.
Yep.
But metal, that's when you start, you know. Though recently I had to model as a chunk of quartz for the Chow Chow Wing, which I thought would not work because it was just filled with tiny little reflective surfaces. But it actually came together.
Okay.
So even though I've been doing photogrammetry for 5, 6, maybe even 7 years now, and I still get surprised, you know. So there'll be something I'm like, absolutely not, it's not going to work. And then it works, and you think, oh, great, that's fantastic.
So, I mean, if photogrammetry is part of the future of archaeology and it's one of the tools that we'll be using increasingly, and already are, but, I mean, how are students training, not just in terms of using the end result of the objects that you've captured, but actually being trained in photogrammetry? What are some of the skills that they can pick up as they go along?
Oh, I love teaching photogrammetry. So if anyone who's listening wants to actually learn, just contact me because I will happily give you instructions. The first thing, even though you can do photogrammetry with, say, like your phone, like an iPhone or, you know, Android, it is possible. You're just, your resolution is not going to be the same as what you get from a DSLR or a mirrorless. So the first piece of advice I would say is to learn how to take a photo, not just point and shoot. Learn what aperture is and what ISO and shutter speed, and, you know, learn how to actually position your camera correctly. You know, that's, it sounds stupid, but you'd be surprised.
It's the same, but the same skill set as old-fashioned archaeological photography of, you know, all of those photographs of Greek vases and of stone tools that we know from publications from sort of 30, 40, 50, 100 years
ago. Absolutely. It's the same thing. So it would be, if you want to go and do any type of photogrammetry, learn how to take a photo. And then there's a lot of freeware online if you want to actually try a hand at actually modeling something. I use both Metashape and Reality Capture. They're very expensive software types, but they're very, very, very good. Like the every year, when every time I get an update, they're just getting smarter and smarter. So,
what have you captured for pleasure? You know, are there things at home that you thought, oh, I want to model that?
Oh, there's so many things. I actually want to do a human. I've not done someone yet.
Right.
I really want to get someone's face, but I don't know if anyone could stay really still. Yeah, for so long. So, no, there's a lot of things I would love to do. I'd have done a portion of my parents' home. I don't think they know that I did that. I just went out and wanted to see if it would work. But along the way, I've modeled some really cool things. I think my highlight was Horus, the mummy in the Chow Chow Wing. I mean, that was just amazing just to be just so close and just see the detail. It was just beautiful. And definitely doing anything underwater. It is a lot of fun. I mean, it's scary because, you know, you get so just enraptured with what you're doing and then you don't check your gauge to see how much air you've got.
All the other complications associated with diving, yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. Madeline Robinson is my guest for this episode. So, Madeline, going back to the coin itself that we're talking about, back to Athens, back to the Tetrad Drachm, what does that coin mean for you? I mean, obviously, it represents something of a struggle in terms of you being
challenge.
Able to do this. But but as an object, how do you respond to it?
It's so beautiful. I like I said before, I really just want to hold it. Every time I see it, I'm like, I have that urge just to pick it up and feel the weight. It's so stunning. If you've got the opportunity to have a look at it, definitely look at it because you can just see just the way that she's represented with Athena's face. You can get so much from the detail and the iconography. It's just, it's really quite, I don't even know what the word is. It's just very, it makes you think. It really makes you wonder about who made it. What's the story behind the people that actually used it. So
it's a very evocative image too, because
Athena
herself in profile is so typical of that. I mean, interestingly, in terms of what's happening in freestanding sculpture at the time, the facial features have changed a little bit. But so in many ways, she's sort of early classical, but that very serene face that the gods and goddesses would have within the classical Greek tradition. And of course, this has been picked up by art historians and by classicists and classical archaeologists, but it's stunningly beautiful.
Serene is exactly the right word. She's not smiling, but she's not indifferent. There's a definite, very godlike facial expression. Her eyes, I think, actually, her eye is the thing that draws me in. They are very big. It is very big.
That's the
prominent
olive shape. Yeah, yes. And very Greek nose as well.
I can share that with her. Can I say this is, for me personally, I like seeing iconography like this.
So, I mean, it's interesting. Every time I have someone on the program, I'm conscious of the fact that part of that relationship with whatever object people choose is based on observation of how much time they've spent looking at it. as part of their research or cultural connection or whatever the case may be. But I suspect that you have probably looked at this coin for more hours than any other guest, both through firstly the camera lens, but then also on a screen while the software is matching it together.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say easily, oh my God, I would hate to think how many hours that's really. Yeah, and actually, you know what? It's definitely not the worst in terms of the amount of time that I've spent on an object. You know, there are models which I've spent months to make, you know.
Yes, yeah.
But I feel like I have looked at this coin in every perceivable angle that is actually possible. because actually, I don't. This is one of the reasons why this object was chosen, is because. Looking at it is such a joy. It's just so beautiful.
And, of course, the beauty of you capturing it this way is that anyone can jump onto our website or jump onto Sketchfab and actually look at it closely themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's democratizing the process of learning about ancient coinage in this case, but archaeological material more generally.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Even if you just have a mild interest in you know, Greek coins, or if you actually are wanting to look into the history of, you know, Athena representations on coins. Mm. There's whatever reason that you have to look at it. Playing around with these photogrammetry models just give you a new perspective and actually make you think quite differently about, you know, these objects. It gives a different meaning to just going to a museum and having a look, because you're able to actually do something, to actually interact with the object without hurting it at all, which is, you know,
the
main. For museums' perspective, that's a really important thing.
Well, there are certain objects that just can't be handled for whatever reason. Coins are obviously far more robust than many things, but this enables that digital handling in a way that, you know, anywhere in the globe, people can get up close to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The key thing that draws a lot of museums into photogrammetry is the fact that fragile objects, they're never touched. You can take, you know, this is all remote sensing. You're taking photos of an object that, you know, would not survive being held, just if it's organic or if it's just fragile, you know, for any reason. Making a model of it makes an imprint that cannot be changed for the rest of time.
Yep.
If it gets eroded away, if it gets destroyed, or just slowly, degrades over time, you have a copy that is impenetrable to time. And that is really, really important, because in archaeology, that's always an issue. You know, if it's, say if it is a shipwreck, people, we now know to never bring up shipwrecks because they just start decaying.
Yeah.
But if you have a model of it, you can do all these analyses. You can look at morphology, look at the engineering of a monument, take it away piece by piece, or even, you know, bring it back to its original glory.
Recreate.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we're unlimited by our own imagination here, because once you have a 3D digital replica, you can do anything and everything with it. So it's really, really useful. And not even, like, that's before we even get to 3D printing, which is another favorite thing of mine, is just I love to actually 3D print objects. And from, you know, that side, when you've got the object again in your hand, that's really useful, because you can actually go to physically touching it again without hurting the original.
Yeah. Coins, of course, are also so difficult to exhibit in a museum context because of, you know, you either have to display the obverse or the reverse if they're lying flat in a display case. If you try and put them in some sort of stand, then visitors have to walk around them.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen exhibitions where people have used mirrors,
but you're not quite
capturing the same thing. And, of course, they're small, so it's really only one person at a time. But, of course, also using this enables a much wider audience within a museum context as well for exhibitions. Not that this one's on exhibition at the moment, either the coin or the recording, but it is now a tool that we have in future if we do an exhibition of coinage.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really, it enables, as I said before, you can zoom in, look right up into what's actually happening on the surface of the coin, and you know, you can have 5,000 people looking at it at one time, and no one gets pushed aside, you know, or has to.
And the coin itself is safe.
Yeah. Which is the key thing here. We want to keep all our objects safe. And,
Now, everyone who appears on the podcast, I ask the same question. If you could choose any one word in the English language to describe what this coin means to you, what is it?
Oh, that's a good one. I want to say two things, because one, I've got my photogrammetry side.
Please do.
That's challenge. That would be the word, is Because, yes, this took two goes to get the model. And as I said, the first round was really not successful. I had to rethink how to do it completely. But also, oh, it sounds so cliche, but just beauty. It's just really stunning.
Yeah. On that note, what would you like? Now, unfortunately, the coin is not on display, but obviously through Sketchfab, and I'll have the links in the website, you can see this coin closer than you could if you were viewing it on exhibition. What would you like our listeners to get out of the experience of actually engaging with this 2,500-year-old coin, but through their screen of their phone or their tablet or their desktop?
Oh, think about who used it. Who picked it up, put it in their pocket, who traded, you know, what did they trade to get it? I think about the backstory. It's always about the people. That's what archaeology is. We're looking at material to answer questions about the people, you know, of our past, of our history. So, yeah, have a good look at the impressions on the surface. Like, have a really good look and all the detail, but also have a think about the people who used it.
And the people who recorded it for us as well, too.
Yes.
Thank you, Madeline. So, look, that's National Archaeology Week 2022. For our listeners who would like to engage more with what's happening in archaeology in Australia at the moment, jump on their website or check out the social media pages. Lots of activities right across the country. Very quickly, Madeline, how can we keep up to date with what's happening in archaeology at the University of Sydney?
So the easiest and best way would be through following our Instagram page, which I actually run. It's at Sydney Archaeology. So, yeah, just chuck into Google and it should come up.
Fantastic. Thank you. Madeline, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. Objects Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pays our respect to the traditional custodians of the lands. We honour and respect the elders past, present and emerging.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.